Right, welcome back everybody. We're talking with Mikael Jalving about Absolute Sweden, his book that has been censored and denied in Sweden. And of course, we have to give him the opportunity to come on this program to talk about it, to get out his opinions, because freedom of speech is not prominent in Sweden. And if you do have certain opinions, you are not welcomed. So there is an interesting one-way tolerance here. And it goes back to that idea as well about the Swedish Democrats, Mikael, that you mentioned before. I mean, I'm not into politics. I really don't think that the solution is there. I'm not really into government either, personally. But nonetheless, it's interesting that when a political party, a democratic political party, comes into power, it's this reaction that happened at the time when they entered into the parliament, because they got, you know, enough votes to do so. There was almost this sentiment around the country, it seemed like, and among the political establishment, that they would have to ban the party, because we all collectively know that this is not what we want, correct?
Yeah, it's a sad story, actually. Democracy, you have to accept your enemies, you have to debate them, you have to fight them by way of wording or politics, by way of making other people believe what you're saying. I mean, this is a oratorical and a idealistic way of dealing with the conflicts within a society that is so different from the violence of totalitarian regimes. But I guess in this case of Sweden, there is a segment of totalitarianism, or wanting to control the opinions of other people, that has been a component of modern this modern collective identity of Sweden since at least since World War II. I guess we have to talk a bit about World War II, because that was a special thing for Sweden in comparison to its neighbors.
Definitely,
of course, Sweden was neighbor to not only the Soviet Union but also Germany. Like the other Scandinavian countries, it found itself between a rock and a hard place at that time. While the Norwegians and, to some extent, the Danish population fought against or did some sabotage to the Germans who occupied Norway and Denmark during the World War II, the Swedish solution to the problem was to collaborate. I mean, this is not something that I make up, but this is sheer facts and has been acknowledged, I must say, by modern-day historians, Swedish historians as well. There was a huge export of steel and other crucial industrial material.
Ball bearings from SKF factory in Gothenburg, the iron ore. Definitely, I mean, this is the Wallenberg
being
family.
Transported through Sweden to Germany, or to Norway, to the German occupied Norway. And there was a standing procedure in which the Swedish media during the war time censored itself. I mean, there was a way of doing it, and a standing operating procedure, and only a few editors, writers, journalists dared to provoke, dared to criticize the line of argument, the line of the policy of the government, Swedish government. Mm-hmm. And since this, I mean, the Swedes they weren't involved in the First World War. They kept out of that war as well. So in the 20th century, the Swedes have had this ability to stay out of conflicts, and I think that's quite crucial in the time after World War II, post war time, because the story told by the government and the elites in Sweden was that it's better to stay out and to find a way of being neutral the West and to the East as well. Mm. But underneath the surface, of course, the government was more sympathetic to the Western powers. So, I mean, in all levels of society, you have this double standards or this paradox between staying neutral officially and then in the real stuff where it matters, you do this or that. And the success story of Sweden, told in Sweden after World War II, was that once you stay out and you concentrate on exporting, on building up industrial power, once you do that, you get rich. And that was what the Swedes actually succeeded in doing at the time of 1970. Sweden was, I think, was number four on the best off list.
Right, wealthiest countries, whatever.
OECD or whatever the list was named at that time.
This was also done during that time that this was seen. The welfare state was obviously seen as a tremendous successful story.
That's part of the success. And, I mean, you have a quasi socialist country being number four. I mean, in terms of wealth and industrial output and welfare systems. I mean, after Switzerland, after Liechtenstein. I mean, you had an average income. I mean, way above the Danish standard or the Spanish standard at the time.
Yep.
And this political success of avoiding warfare, the economic success of being number four or number three in the world in combination, I think made many Swedes think that they were living in the best of all worlds. I mean, they were on top of the world, and that grew a specific and accelerated the optimism and the belief in progress and the quest for social planning, and also this futuristic longing or heartbeat that is so visible in the Palme era. The belief that you can plan the future, the belief that you can control all conflicts, you can downtone them by way of internal censorship in terms of, steering, organizing, planning, rationalizing.
Do you think that that's a delusion?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think you have to accept the preeminence of conflict in all social contexts. And I mean, we human beings, we cannot but conflict. We cannot but argue. We cannot but being...
Well, that's my point. We're almost at a stage now where we're asked to not be humans anymore. That's what I see happening anyway.
Yeah, well, that's strongly put. But the tendency or the drive for social planning, for order, for uniformity is
very
predominant.
Important. Very important.
And then that's a very strong feature. Once you have it, I mean, it's difficult to not march along the masses. I mean, it's difficult to be an individual in a collectivist or a uniform group of people.
Indeed. I mean, sorry to interrupt, but this is just so interesting. I want to ask a little bit more about this because we do have concepts like the folkhemmet. I've tried to describe this in the past. It's a concept of how a home for the people should be. It's a very difficult word to translate, but that's basically the concept of it. On top of that, you have the jantelag, which basically is a pattern of group behavior towards individuals, and this is specifically within Scandinavian communities, which negatively portrays and criticizes individual success and achievement as unworthy and inappropriate. So what does these things, how does this help to shape the country, do you think?
I mean, these are very strong... I mean, that's a tough background to have for a country, right? I mean, of course, we have the Jante law. I mean, it's a Norwegian invention, and we have it in Denmark as well. It's a Scandinavian feature. But we never had the same strong belief in a folks home or the folkhemmet, a uniform social democratic utopia. We never had that kind belief that you could actually realize it, I mean, you could actually make it happen. I mean, of course, we have the ideas or the ideals the dreaming about a perfect society. I mean, that's something human too, I guess, the whole utopian tendency within the human nature to imagine, and the willingness to change for the better, etc., etc.
Of course.
But in Sweden, it was more than an ideal in the 60s and the 70s, which is a very formative period for the Sweden we're talking about today. There was more than a longing. There was an expectation that you could actually create such a society. And that's to me is quasi-totalitarian, to think that your ideas can be realized, can be manifest, can become reality. That to me is really scary.
Because we're talking about a few individuals that has this idea for the masses.
Yeah. True. I mean, of course, the masses like progress. I mean, economic, material progress. Who don't? But it's obvious once you start studying these topics that the utopianism of the Swedish elite was indeed an elitist phenomenon. Yeah. It was something that was invented in political, administrative, bureaucratic circles, like most policy is, I'm afraid to say. It was something that came about within the system and also within all the parties. I mean, there was a unison sympathy for Foxhemmet, for the utopian collective project. There was hardly any debate about it. Not before Olof Palme made the mistake to argue I don't know the word in English, but he was calling for under pressure from the socialist lobby organizations within the working organization, labor blue labor organizations. Mm-hmm. He went for Lønmodtagerfonde, which is do you get it?
No, I don't. Sorry.
This was in the 70s. Never mind. I mean, okay. Technicality. I mean, he made a technical mistake. That's my point.
Okay. Yeah.
And due to this technicality, 75,000 Swedes, non-socialist Swedes, went to the streets in a demonstration in Stockholm in. Maybe it was in early 80s. Never mm-hmm. mind. Doesn't
okay.
matter.
Yeah.
But it was due to a technicality. I mean, he wanted collective control of the boards of commercial companies, and he wanted it now.
Wow.
I mean, maybe some of the American listeners wouldn't agree this is a technicality, but in Sweden it was because there was so much collective thinking to begin with. So in the Swedish context, it was a technicality that caused protest.
Yeah. Well, it's to me, it's a nightmare scenario that's being described. No matter how well intended it is, or no matter how well it actually is to live within it, this idea of an egalitarian utopia is a horrible one to me. I mean, we have effects of it coming through today. We don't have the same Sweden today, of course. It's very much different. This is one point you made in the beginning of the program, but we have, this is now reflecting itself like things that came out a couple of months ago, maybe it's even a year now, about the genderless pronoun that was introduced in Sweden. You can't call a little boy him or a little girl her anymore. You have to say hen in some of the schools in Stockholm now, because they're like, again, it's about the erosion of individuality, the erosion of the person, if you will, into this kind of ant-like society where you are nothing. You're not an individual in that. You're just one among everyone else, and you cannot and you should not stand out in any way. And it's a horrible picture that's described. And it was worse, I think, in the 60s and 70s, but we still very much are painted by this history today. Would you agree with that, Mikael?
Partly. I mean, I think you might say that this neutrality in the foreign policy has a spillover in the gender issue, in gender-free schools or in gender-free wording of people. It is, of course, an erosion of the individual, but it is also maybe worse, even worse, an erosion of culture. It's an erosion right. of the way things have been throughout the times.
Yeah.
It's an erosion of basic fundamentals that happen to be more crucial to the welfare of a society than we normally think about. It's something that children would protest against, and therefore, I guess it's something worthwhile defending.
Yeah.
I believe in children, like in the case of this play in Oslo, the play that was banned, or this children's play.
Mm-hmm.
If he or she is no longer valid categories, children will protest, and I think they have the right to protest, and I agree with them, because it's something we shouldn't mess up. It's something we shouldn't mess up, and it has a price. It comes with a price tag.
Oh, of course it does.
And it comes with a price tag, not only for the children that get completely confused about the basics of their upbringing,
sure.
basics of their the family structure, etc. It's also it has to do with the deconstruction of meaning and tradition and
Orwellian.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yep.
Deep down, it is, and it applies the same kind of, to me, sick neutrality into the intimacy, I mean, the private sector, the private logic of family life, or the logic of the individual. That one, I mean, all of a sudden you could become something in between a man and a woman.
That's right. But the argument here from the other side is that this is seen from a materialistic scientific point of view in most regards, even if that's valid or not from the point of view of accurate science. But nonetheless, these are seen as social constructs. Mm. To me, I see this as a disassociation from the natural world and reality. And that's why we enter into a world of social engineering, if you will, because it's not anymore about what actually happens out there in the real world. It's about politics. It's what you can do with social planning, as you said before, Mikael, and completely shape and form the citizens, if you will, within the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's planning. It's a way of. Constructing a perfect world, in a sense. I mean, the world of neutrality, the world of no tensions, the world of no natural differences. It's an egalitarian image construction. I never imagined this would come up as a point of discussion, but it is in Sweden. It's not even an issue in Denmark or in Finland or in Norway, I guess. Maybe a bit in Norway, but in Germany, for certain, it's not. But this has to do with the growing feminist scientific brand of researchers and intellectuals in Sweden, mostly women, putting forward these neutrality, egalitarian arguments that seem to invade all sorts of social practice and daily life, and however innocent it may sound,
yeah.
on the surface,
yeah.
it involves rather scary implications in my view, and that's why we have to discuss it. Otherwise, I would tend to ignore it, because I think it's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, it's irrelevant to the economic evolution of Sweden or any other country. It's irrelevant to immigration, or irrelevant in terms of, I mean, international foreign policy or whatever. But it's an issue in Sweden, and that's the funny thing about Sweden. You go there, you think it's like any other normal European country, but it's not. It's a country in which polygamy and gender-free categorizations is hot stuff. That's what the intellectuals talk about.
Yeah.
Seriously,
yeah.
In television, in the mainstream media, in radio programs. That's really the hot issue. While the world is burning, all sorts of things happen. Yeah. This seems to be of crucial importance in Sweden. And to me, that's, I mean, you may laugh, but somehow it's tragic.
Well, it is. I mean, there's a bigger problem at bay here as well. We have government subsidies for media, for print, for television, for radio, for everything. I mean, the media is very much controlled in Sweden, although there is an alternative one, of course, and I think an increasing rising one for many of the reasons that we've talked about so far here. Mm. But it's very much centrally controlled, centrally regulated from one point, a diktat, if you will, that stretches out in all directions. And it seems almost impenetrable. It's like difficult to get in there. And what I want to know is if you have looked into this at all, but what sways that opinion of what is the topic of the day of or the issues that are important? That has to be a regulating body somewhere that decides this, correct?
Mm-hmm. But the regulating, I mean, of course there are exceptions. Of course there are very good and brave, a few good men within the mainstream media in Sweden. I mean, and there are exceptions and people that tend to learn from experience and I mean, even TV, television journalists doing good documentaries or every now and then. But that's exceptions to the rule that yeah. uniformity is predominant and also the moral indicator and the moral agenda of things being discussed. But there are, as you mentioned, resistance media throughout the country, and day on a day by day basis they grow. I mean, if you study the statistics, you see that, for instance, an anti-establishment media like Aupixlat.se, I think that the biggest right now, the most read, is more read, more clicked at than big regional papers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something new. It didn't used to be like this, say, even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The growth rate of blogs and anti-establishment media is I mean, Chinese. I mean, the growth rate is Chinese, so to speak, or Indian, Brazilian. Mm. And that is, of course, a great taboo and a scary thing for the mainstream media, because they live from traffic as well, from readership and from readers. I mean, as far as I can see, they're in a panic. I mean, they're in a panic due to the financial crisis, the lack of readers. I mean, people don't want to pay for news anymore, since they've become accustomed to clicking on news for free. And also because there is a growing feeling within the Swedish population that the mainstream media are not describing the reality and the news in a objective or balanced or precise way.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Say, one example, the one we mentioned before, we talked about before, the happening in Gothenburg. I was trying to figure out what happened. I was in Copenhagen. I was reading the mainstream media, and I couldn't make sense of what took place. Then I went to YouTube, and I saw clips, amateur clips, recordings of the happening. And then I got a sense. Then I got an idea of what was happening, but it wasn't reflected in the mainstream media. They were talking about ungdomar, which is just youth. What I saw on the YouTube being spread around in the underground media was, maybe a group of 500 youngsters, say 90% Middle Eastern origin or background, non-Swedish ethnic background. That's what I saw. So why don't you describe it? I mean, this is what you see, but it's not reflected in the media, mainstream media. And I had to go to Aupixlat or Fria Tider or other anti-establishment media to get a better idea of what was happening. And that is a rather obvious illustration that something is rotten in Sweden. I mean, you have to have a basic belief or trust in your media. Otherwise, you're forced into all sorts of alternative medias, and that's what's happening now.
And I see that as a good thing ultimately, because they have proven themselves not to be worthy of the attention of everybody, because they're focused on false reporting and furthering obfuscation of the truth. So ultimately,
it is good for the good. But me being employed by a mainstream media in Denmark tends to think that this is also bad, in the sense that the mainstream media are simply losing their legitimacy.
Yeah, indeed. But again, they're doing it to themselves, and this is the way it is. Now, so what's happening right now? How do you see things changing? I mean, we see all across Europe a rise, if you will, then, of so-called right-wing parties. Mm. In Holland, I don't know if Germany, but Switzerland, in Sweden and everything else. So what is this about? What is that reflection of? Why is this is being, again, kind of just brushed under the rug and not really talked about or addressed a larger issue here? But why is this happening in your view?
Yeah. Well, one easy description would be to say, well, this is just a repetition of pre-war Europe in the 30s. This is racism and fascism on the rise. Mm-hmm. We have to fight it. We have to block these people. We have to put them under surveillance. We have to limit their freedom of speech. Otherwise, they'll win more supporters. And this is basically the explanation given by mainstream media and politicians in Sweden. There's another description, of course, which is, well, what's going on is putting us to a test. We have to look into what is this. Can there be a rational reason or background for this so-called right-wing policy of protest throughout Europe? Can there be social, economic, daily life reasons for the fact that more people are turning skeptic of immigration? Can there be other explanations? I think that's the explanation that has the upper hand right now. Accepting that you cannot reduce the social protest, the political protest, to sheer racism. I mean, that's just a cartoon explanation. That's just that's too easy. I think the complicated matter of what's taking place in Europe right now asks for a more sophisticated way of describing trends and and sociological movements and day-to-day normal things and problems taking place in Paris, in London, in various suburbs, in various ghettos of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Brussels, Copenhagen, Gothenburg. I mean, there are similarities. There are problems, sociological, cultural problems that are similar. The rise in violence. Not only. I mean, I'm not talking about car stealing. I'm talking about harder types of crime is on the rise throughout Europe. Why is that? We have to look into this, and there's no single explanation, but there might be rational reasons for people turning right wing. We have to accept that. I mean, normally when we were discussing the rise of the 68 movement throughout Europe. I mean, we were also looking into. Our parents were looking into rational reasons for becoming left-wing. I mean, we cannot just say that these people were voting for Sweden, so Democrats or the Dutch Party, the True Finns in Finland. We cannot just say that they're racists. That's simply too easy.
Yeah, it's again, it's to avoid avoid the issue, I think. And the sentiment now seems to be as well, Lorna, and you kind of said this before, that this is a problem from the mainstream or the current political elite, that these issues will have to be dealt with. Otherwise, we're talking about people who will develop into Anders Behring Breivik, for example. You know, that this is how they've potentially might try to let's say, shut down debate or something like that. That there have to be limitations on the expression of freedom of speech on the internet. Otherwise, yeah. You know, ergo, it will lead to those kinds of situations again. Have you seen that they've kind of played it that way? And if so, is there anything that could be argued against that?
Yeah, but I mean, it's a fact. I mean, this is what's going on in Sweden right now, that the establishment is trying to limit the freedom of speech on the web. Of course, with the best of motives, tolerance, as non-prejudiced motives, etc. But the consequence is that you build up this culture of fear, this culture of self-censorship, that goes back to the first thing we spoke about. What is the biggest problem? The biggest problem is when you have a population or a big minority within a society that do not dare raise their hands and argue and discuss. But there are, I mean, this is a general trend in Sweden, in Denmark, in Norway, in Scandinavia, in the European Union. I mean, there is a general acceptance of more limits to the freedom of speech. I mean, I cannot see that this is something completely can I see this? It's completely disrupted from the fact that we have now a large and growing population of people coming from Muslim countries. This is connected, of course. We seem to give into a false kind of tolerance, limiting what's most crucial in a society: the place for discussion, the open discussion, debating of all taboos. But we tend to go along this European self-censorship in thoughts, in arts, in theater, in writing, in movies, adverts, and all sorts of expressions are looked at with a moralistic censorship potentially involved.
Do you think ultimately that religion in the back of everything is a problem, that this is where the clash is about, or is it I mean, religion and culture, they're, of course, you know, hand in glove in a way. It's in many countries, not all, but so I think it might be, you know, weird or wrong to juxtapose that with saying, or is it the problem of cultures colliding? But how big of an issue is religion in all this, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. It calls for a long answer, but the short one would be that there is, to a certain extent, there is a conflict between religions, or between religion and politics, between we and us. But there is also, and that's, I think, a thing we tend to forget also, is that there is a discussion within the Swedish society, within the ethnic Swedes or the ethnic Danes or the ethnic Norwegians. A conflict going on within the ethnic within the nation, so to speak, a discussion about what kind of society we want. I mean, a discussion about what we inherited from our predecessors, and what kind of society we want to give to our own children. Do we want to give in to the idea that we hold no? We share no culture. We hold no culture. We hold no past. We hold no religion. We hold no tradition. Or do we stand up for the good laws we have, for the principles, for the norms, for the culture, also the historical success of our nations, the wealth that it built in the 50s, 60s? Do we defend what we find most sacred in our societies? I think that's the crucial discussion among Swedes or among Danes or among Norwegians. And we tend to forget this discussion because we focus perhaps between a discussion about a confrontation between Christianity or Islam or whatever. Those concepts or those religions are, I mean, that's a very difficult discussion. What sure. is Islam? You can do a whole series of programs about that. What is Christianity? I mean, I don't know, but I have my own view. But the discussion within the society about what is sacred here, what is worth fighting for, that's the one that we have now and have had in Denmark and still seems to be absent in Sweden.
What's interesting now about democracy as it exists and in Europe currently is that there is a conflict on the rise from the ideological point of view, because we're talking about majority rule democracy, but then inside of that you have minorities, and also we have a number of people, we have growth of different people and populations and everything. And what seems to be happening now then is that eventually if this goes on for long enough, we might be faced with the situation due to the democracy that there will be a majority or whatever you can say there, that there will be Christianity in one part of a country, but then there will be a demand for example, Sharia law to exist side by side in within the same country due to the fact that these are now two major peoples that are living in one country. In the old days, this was there's been endless amounts of conflict, of course, in Europe. But do you think that it's even possible that this can exist in one of the European countries at the same time? Or are they so diametrically opposed that there will have to be, I don't know, segregation, a country to split up? How do you see this future-wise? What's going to happen?
It's an open question. I don't take myself to be a prophet, so I tend to avoid that kind of questions, but I do my best. I mean, this segregation is already happening. I mean, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in France, it's happening in some parts of Denmark as well. It's not a formal segregation, but it's a sneaking social segregation. Various parts of Copenhagen I wouldn't like to go to at night. And I definitely wouldn't like my daughter whenever she's ready for it. I wouldn't like her to go there. Not because I'm a racist, because I'm pragmatic. I mean, the rate of crime is higher there. The nightlife there is far more brutal than in other parts of say the city. So it's not due to racism. It's due to some kind of rationality, pragmatic observation of reality that I wouldn't like my future daughter to go there. But I don't know what will happen. I mean, the optimistic version is that once these second or third or fourth generation immigrants have stayed here for enough time, they'll become quasi-Danish, quasi-Swedish, quasi-Norwegian, or whatever. But as far from we can judge right now, it doesn't look like that. It looks the opposite. It looks as if third generation immigrants are less integrated than their fathers and mothers. But why is that? I mean, that's a good question. I don't have the objective or the final answer for that.
Sure.
But I think we have to look into this. This is sociology. This is culture. This is reality taking place right now in urban areas.
But we can't talk about it.
If segregation is a fact already,
yeah.
I think it calls for a reflection on whether or not democracy is enough in itself. We tend
right.
to we tend to think that democracy is the final solution to everything. This is a Scandinavian idea.
Democracy, sorry to interrupt you, but democracy is you know, two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for dinner. That's democracy.
Yeah, that's a cruel definition. there's a more noble one, but never mind. What my point is that democracy is not enough. There has to be basic rights of freedom of press, freedom of thought, freedom of religion. There has to be basic rights on property. You have to have the right to defend your property, not only from criminals, but also from taxation, which is complete taboo in Scandinavia. I mean, we put up taxes every fortnight. Not only the visual taxes, but also the invisible taxes in terms of VAT and what have you not.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we have to start thinking about democracy as a limited good, as a limited virtue. There has to be more than democracy to have a free society, or to have the most free society you can have on earth, right?
Yeah.
So you have to guard those rights.
They're inalienable, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a very difficult word for Scandinavian to pronounce.
Tongue twister right there.
But
yeah.
They are. You can lose them. They are not in whatever it's pronounced as.
Mm.
You can lose them. That's my point. And we are losing them in Europe right now, thanks to the European Union and thanks to the predominant tolerance and the predominant defiance of the best of European culture. That is to, I mean, in one example is the freedom of press and the freedom of free speech and etc. So democracy cannot stand alone. There has to be more to guard it, to avoid democracy turning into some kind of quasi dictatorship.
Well, some people have argued then also that the solution to this is because the nation state is dead. We can see this with true and active concepts like the new world order, world government, etc., that we're all meant to just be basically smaller regions, again, that are dictated to by a central global government. And some people have even argued that this is the solution to it. This is going to make it better. I think that's going to make things even worse. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree about that. I think we have to acknowledge that the nation as an idea and a practice throughout the last 200 years of European Western history is an immense success. I mean, it has survived all sorts of empires and world wars and utopian thinking, communism, Nazism, whatever, what have you not. It's still there. There are more nations in Europe than ever before, and more people, more and more groups of people want to have their own nation, to have their sovereignty. I think the nation actually is a very good soil for the principles, because the nation can protect in a very practical manner, can protect the rights. It can actually take the violators to prison. They can condemn them. The nations can control the territory in a way that an empire never will be able to do. So the nations are very bad spoken of, especially in Sweden, because most Swedes tend to associate the nation with the concept of the nation with xenophobia and racism, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
But the nation as a soil for democracy is a very good combination, I think.
All right. So obviously there's a lot of issues arising here. The world is in changing. It's in flux. Things are happening, and there's a lot of issues that you deal with in the book that goes into these sensitive topics. Things that are again suppressed. They're not allowed to be talked about. And we're doing our best to just kind of air this out a little bit and letting these topics flow freely, if you will. Because I think again, just to go back to that point, one of the worst things that can happen is when you put the lid on. That's when really bad and extreme kind of, you know, situations occur, because again, it becomes like a pressure cooker. If you can't talk about it and openly, you know, recognize what's going on, and then try to air or voice these opinions, it's just going to get worse. But Mikael, is there anything beyond this, beyond the things that we've been talking about so far, that we've kind of been missing out on, some important you know, facts or figures or something that you want to kind of add on to the discussion here as we kind of begin here in a little while to round things up? Anything else?
Yeah, how much time have we left?
We can say around 10 minutes maybe. It doesn't really matter. We're not really limited per se, but...
Well, I mean, maybe I should say that I actually kind of like Sweden. I mean, it sounds as if I'm hammering on Sweden and the Swedish political elite, etc. I mean, I find it a beautiful country. It's I mean, the Swedes are in general very polite and nice people. You can actually get to talk to them once you have them on one to one, or I mean, once they've had their first beer or whatever. I mean, they start to talk. It's not as if they are not humans. Of course they are, and they have to share the same fears and hopes and dreams like all sorts of people. It's just that Sweden of today has become a very particular country in which you might say the extreme has become mainstream.
Yeah,
the radical has become normal. The extravagant or the utopian has become reality, and that to me is something to worry about. And I kind of feel that what we're talking about here has to do with the more or less universal adaptation of the 68 movement into the Swedish establishment. In all other European countries, there was a culture. A fight or a culture war between various parties, various lobbies, various intellectuals. You had heated discussions on art, on politics, on theology, on science, on all sorts of things. Whereas in Sweden, you had hardly any resistance from the old Sweden, from the old establishment, confronting the 68 movement, winning its territory up to the 70s and 80s.
Can you briefly describe what the 68 movement was about for those who don't know?
Yeah, I mean the left wing protest against what they saw as a reactionary bourgeois way of running countries that rose in the month of May in 68 in Paris, France. That's why we say 68, the leftist, radical, Marxist, or even Maoist protest against democracy, against social democracy, against liberalism, against conservatism, I mean, against all sorts of the then establishment or the previous consensus. And this thing was, to begin with, in France and in subsequent countries, was a student revolt.
Yeah.
A student thing at the university. It was a scientific, political awakening, but it spread into academia in general, and into politics, into culture. So it was just not a student thing. Thanks to Sartre, thanks to other intellectual dynamos, the student rhetoric won its way into broader mainstream culture. A person like Steve Jobs, for instance, is maybe the perfect 68. I mean, he even made a fortune afterwards. He was the radical iconoclast. He was a Marxist, or very left-wing at least, back then, in the west coast of America. And he transformed. He's actually the best case scenario. I mean, he made his fortune in computing and in digital invention and all that. And he was extremely successful in a very productive way. I mean, I'm stressing this. But we had other radicals that turned anti-commercial, that turned socialist. I mean, in not only in their rhetoric, but also in their doing, in their working. And they took over Sweden much more than other countries in Europe. I mean, say if the present prime minister of Sweden were to go to America and vote, he'd belong to the left wing of the Democratic Party.
Oh, there's no comparison. I remember when Carl Bildt allegedly, you know, and he's kind of the face of the conservative in Sweden, if you will. Mm. He's known on the international scene, but allegedly there is this one story when he went to America to actually do a talk, and he talked about the importance of labor unions, and he was booed off the stage as a commie.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if the story is true or not, but I just thought it was funny because it shows the parallels that all the options are left of left in Sweden. There is hardly any center, and definitely not any right. So
And this was something that took place in the 70s when Palme had peaked in the 60s. When the Swedish television wanted to have a discussion there, they'd have Palme in the studio and they'd have a communist. I mean, that was the scene.
Wow.
And you wouldn't have a liberalist or a anarchist or libertarian.
Never, never.
There were hardly any to begin with, but they were not part of the game.
And they're still not part of the game. That's what we're getting to here as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, right. I don't know about the libertarians. They are invisible if they ever exist. Well, they do actually exist, but they hold this kind of liberalism that calls for open. I mean, no borders, and I mean, they call for immigration by liberal arguments, saying there cannot be national borders. That's against liberalism. That's the kind of liberalism you'll get. I mean, the most right-wing liberalism, so to speak, in Sweden. The rest is rather. I mean, that's a consensus. I mean, far left of center by American standards. Even by European standards, the Swedish political picture is definitely left wing.
Yeah, indeed, it's true. It's and that's what we're also what I'm getting at here in terms of one of the important points to make. I'm not a big fan of the dialectic system of just basically having two opposites fight out each other to come to a common good in a way, but I understand the processes of having two balanced sides on each side of the spectrum to be able to make some kind of common sense in between decision, I guess. Although Sweden has been known as the third way, right? It's been known as the compromise between capitalism and communism. Maybe today, with the corporate monopoly that exists in Sweden in many regards, that's more true than before. But the fact is that there has been it's been so incredibly one-sided, the debate, and so only so focused on the left wing that there has been no balancing wing on the other end to kind of balance things out. That's what I'm getting at. And so, is there any way, in your opinion, to kind of get some balance into a very unbalanced Sweden, if we look at it from that point of view?
Well, then I have to go back to the contrast between events and ideas that I mentioned before. I think it takes momentous big events to change the picture. I mean, it takes reality to form new ideas. It takes events, physical, actual events that are, I mean, you cannot deny them. It took place, like a non-establishment party enters parliament and becomes the third biggest party in Sweden, which is likely to happen next time. Then that's an event. I mean, you cannot deny that. You can, of course, but that's an event that'll change the way the Swedes see themselves. I mean. So I'm a believer in events more than ideas in this sense, because so far the ideas since Olof Palme, since the ideas of social planning, of the futuristic longing, the fatalistic optimism about, just society, the good society. All these ideas have been so predominant throughout a whole generation, and they're still there. And in fact, they are becoming radicalized as we speak, in feminism, in gender talk, in gender ideology, the obsession with solidarity with the poor people of the world, with the Palestinians, for instance. The solidarity argument is still very, very strong, and it was fostered. It was born in the 70s, and it's still around. And there's hardly no criticism of it. There's hardly no falsifying this blind love with solidarity. So I don't trust ideas to change societies. In the Swedish case, I happen to think that events, drastic events, will perhaps make things change a bit.
All right, let me run this by you as the last kind of thing, and then we can begin to round up. But I've said this before as well, that a baby learns to walk. It's destined to fall over a couple of times and end up in a little bit of a pain. And this is, of course, the incentive to learn how to walk, to not fall into sharp things and stuff like that. But the nature of the social planning in a country like Sweden has been to kind of, and I've said this before, pad all the corners, isolating almost the Swede from reality, from the natural world, so that these things can't. I mean, you're talking about these kinds of events then that happen to a person, and that the event will make them kind of wake up or realize something. They learn a new lesson. And I will see that this isolation then has been very detrimental. No matter how well-meaning it is, and I'm not saying that there should be an open, ended thing that people should hurt themselves. I'm not talking about it in that one-dimensional way.
No, I'm just
talking about the lessons you can learn from nature and the importance of that. But the fact, again, that Swedish society has been tremendously isolated from those things from the longest time. Do you think then that that's changing now that you think that events might occur that are, I guess, so strong that they kind of pierce through this protection of planning and technology and science that kind of buffers the way? What do you think?
A fact like the financial crisis or the debt crisis affects the Swedish economy as well. I mean, there was a tendency for the last 5 years, perhaps, until now, to regard the Swedish economy as a golden child of Europe, like the new Germany or like the China of Europe. And the minister for finance, he went to Davos, this Swiss top meeting of highbrow important ministers and money makers annual event. He went there a few times, and he was the wonder child of Europe. He was
definitely
the
rock star of the event.
The rock star,
exactly. Definitely.
That rhetoric has come to an end. Why? Because Sweden is suffering from the debt crisis as well. Of course they are. I mean, Sweden, that's just adding to my point before, Sweden is part of Europe, part of the world. It's not paradise. They are suffering diminishing output, lack of wealth. I mean, unemployment, social tensions, a downscaling of the welfare state. Stepwise, small, but step by step, they're part of the world. And that goes along with the event theory from before as well. Sweden is no more the tiger economy. It's a normal country, economically speaking. They suffer from not depression yet.
No, that's my point, Mika. They surely haven't suffered like the Greek or Spain or anything like that.
No. And maybe they won't suffer in the same way. In 10 or 20 years, we don't know, but the game is open. We don't know. Europe is on a, we might be on a sinking ship in Europe.
Sure. Yeah.
Not only the Danes or the Norwegians, but also the Swedish.
Sure.
And that is something you can ignore, of course, for a while. But day by day, the Swedes can see that they're worse off than they were a year ago. They're worse off than their fathers and mothers and the previous generations. And their children are not likely to find a job within this or that sector.
Yeah.
They might have to leave the country like they did in the 19th century. I mean, massively, they went to America, as people probably, the listeners probably know. Sweden was for quite some time a huge immigration country. It might, in the future, end up a country that Swedes will leave due to events, due to economic structures, due to lack of progress.
But there is no reality now as there were then. Where should they? Exactly. Where could they go? Right.
Where should they go? Well, yeah, Australia, Canada. And Japan, I don't know. I
mean, Japan.
I mean, this is something that we are acknowledging in Denmark and in Germany mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. But I think with a bit of delay, this realism is creeping into the Swedish behind the Swedish armor these days, and that may be the most likely events that are to happen
right.
instead of a civil war or a low intensive civil war, the welfare states of Europe might crumple and might collapse in a short while. Maybe not in a big bang, but in a unidirection, worse.
Yeah.
And that might change the whole political discussion on various subjects as well. I mean, we don't know.
All right, very good. And of course, what you're saying there is that this ultimately, again, a little bit of uncomfortableness is actually something good. You can actually come out of the situation and manage to turn things around. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. I've really enjoyed it. I think it's very important, again, to hear about these perspectives. Again, things that are not openly discussed, unfortunately, in mainstream media. They're hushed away. They're not allowed for various reasons. So anyway, I'm glad we were able to do it and give you a couple hours here, Mikael, to talk a little bit about your work and your book. But again, then round things up, mentioning the title of your book, if and when you believe it might be out in English, and of course the website, so people know where to go.
Well, the website is absolutsverige.com. That's the Swedish title, absolutsverige, instead of Sweden.com. And the subtitle is Ett land I förandring, which would be a country. What's that? I didn't even think about that.
Country in change.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. it's for sale on the web at absolutsverige.com, and it will be in the bookstores hopefully beginning of February or March at the latest. I want to thank you for inviting me here and having this much time to talk about and reflect upon the Swedish destiny and the past and the culture and all that. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you bet. We are really glad to have been able to do it. All right. Well, thank you. We'll have the links obviously up on the website and everything, and so you guys can check it out there. Okay. Thank you very much, Mikael, for coming on. Really appreciate it again, though.
You too.
Well, thanks, guys, for listening and for staying with us with such an incredibly unbalanced perspective, particularly then in Sweden, due to powerful lobbying by the political elite and media complicity. It is essential that we have a discussion about all of these things. Otherwise, it might turn into something far more problematic. I don't think that's something they anticipate. Well, maybe it is, but there's nothing wrong with talking about these things, as some seem to think. We need to ask, what is going on? Why is it changing? Who is changing things? There needs to be a discourse about this, as Mikael said. Otherwise, the polarization will just get worse and worse. And at the same time, the left media seem to think that they can just shove their heads in the sand and think that the problem will go away. But it won't, and now it's not going to solve anything. It's going to make it worse. But again, all of this is simply reflects the totalitarian nature of the state and that you have no say in it, although they say you do. It's all upside down. Nonetheless, keep thinking, keep asking questions. We're going to shift focus to something completely different next time. as we're going to do a round table on Egypt. In the meantime, take good care wherever you are. Have a good rest of your day and evening. Bye-bye.